Hello, wine aficionados. Today's On the Wine Road adventure will take us back in time. Well, sort of. You know, one of the things I respect most about the wine industry is its rich history. I was thrilled recently to have another chance to visit the historic, iconic Inglenook Winery, one of Napa Valley's oldest estate wineries. Back in October, I attended Wine & Spirits magazine's Top 100 event in San Francisco, as I've mentioned before. During the event, I had the chance to meet Chris Phelps, the associate winemaker at Inglenook. I jumped at the chance to do an interview with Chris. I finally made that happen in December. I've had the opportunity to see the beautiful historic chateau a few years ago and looked forward to seeing it again. You may recall that Francis Ford Coppola purchased the property and went through various incarnations over the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and has really revitalized the estate. If you haven't had the chance to visit, do yourself a favor and make an appointment to do so. Gustav Niebaum, a sea captain from Finland, bought the property in 1879 and began work on building the winery. At that time, only Charles Krug, Schramsberg, and Beringer had a foothold in Napa Valley, so Inglenook has quite a legacy.
Yeah, it's unique. I mean, in that it was really the first true estate winery built in Napa Valley, and vineyards planted 1879. So,
I was astonished when doing research for this interview that the first vintage for Inglenook in 1882 was 80,000 gallons, which is over 33,000 cases. That seems like a lot for the era to me.
It's amazing. I am the same way. I have to look at that figure a few times before I kind of start to believe it again, because it's remarkable at that time and place to have made that much wine.
And then 2 years later, they kicked it up to 52,000 cases. So, yeah. I mean, who was drinking that much wine around here, unless, you know, the miners maybe?
That's a really good question. But I think it even made it to the East Coast.
Yeah.
And it was served at the White House in the 1880s at some point. But today we're only making about 25,000 cases. Now, we're very rigorous with our quality standards, so anything that doesn't make the cut, we sell off. So,
Gustav Niebaum was a Finnish sea captain, and you wouldn't think a man like that in the mid-1800s would be such an entrepreneur, but he sure seemed to be driven and made some wise choices over the years.
Yeah, he had made a boatload of money, no pun intended, in the fur and trading businesses, and when he got to California, I don't know that he intended to stay, but he married an American woman, and she was intent on staying, and he decided, why not, you know, create a Bordeaux type estate in Napa Valley. And somehow intuitively, and talking to locals, he chose what we really think is one of the finest places on the planet to grow grapes.
Sometimes guys like that just always get lucky and hit the right spot.
Yeah, part of it's having the money to do what you want. But yeah, you know, he could have easily chosen someplace else. And it's remarkable here on this bench land in Rutherford. And, you know, Francis and Eleanor Coppola have put back together the original estate. Yeah. It's been a long road, but that's where we are today.
Do you know, I don't know if you've heard about this or not, but did he have some experience with Bordeaux wines or any interest in wine prior to that?
Yeah, well, you know, to have gone to the lengths he did, we can only presume that he had an educated palate. So I think as a consumer, he was educated and knew the wines of Bordeaux, because he brought vine cuttings from France to plant here in 1879. So he had an idea of what he was doing.
Of course, I know that ships back in those days, they carried more wine and rum than they did water, because it was safer to drink.
Exactly. Yeah, when the ballast is consumable in the form of wine.
Right.
Yeah.
When he started hitting those, you know, early years of so many cases, do you know, was his wine respected nationally and even possibly internationally?
Yeah, I don't remember exactly, but there was a World Exposition in Paris where Inglenook won a bunch of awards, and I want to say it was in the 1890s, but it was before the turn of the century. Inglenook actually was recognized worldwide for its wines.
Gustav died in 1908, and I was surprised to see that winemaking stopped for a few years. Was his widow just unprepared to move ahead at that point, do you think?
I don't think it was not a... Well, it's often not a planned thing, but it was... Yeah, there was an interim period there where things were a little shaky, but it was really John Daniel. We're sitting in the Daniel cellar right now, but it was his nephew John Daniel who really took the reins and brought the whole enterprise forward, and really with the same vision that Gustav had, you know, no compromise to quality, which is the legacy that also the Coppolas have brought back today.
Yeah, I saw that. I think he got involved just before Prohibition, then you guys stopped completely during Prohibition, unlike some wineries that continued in some way.
We're still selling grapes, you know, because the vineyard was still here, so I don't know that it was in its entirety, but the vineyard still existed. That's why they could get going right, you know, immediately after Prohibition, because the vineyard was still here.
Then following Prohibition, John Daniel took over and even purchased the property at that point in the winery.
In the 40s and 50s, that was the real Daniel era, you know, and I guess, you know, 1941, which I have not had the privilege of drinking, but that's the wine that got 100 points, you know, in the Wine Spectator, and was a big deal. And
considered a wine of the century.
Definitely, definitely.
You mentioned his managing style, and I guess they had a mantra back then, pride, not profit, that drove them into the 60s.
Well, that's for anyone who really knows the wine business, not just in Napa, but anywhere. I've spent a lot of time in France, and it's the same there. Unfortunately, if you're really dedicated to quality, profit can't be your first motivation, unlike some other businesses.
And people think when they see bottles selling for $100, $200 that you're making a lot of money, but that even at that price, not necessarily so.
No, and it's ever more true today. I mean, we look at the prices of Cabernet and real estate in Napa Valley, and it's no surprise that wines have got to that level. But they're selling well. So.
And it got to the point in the 60s, the winery was nearly 100 years old, needed some updating, so Daniel made the tough decision to sell the winery to Allied Grape Growers in 1964.
Yep, and then he passed away in 1970, and there was a whole era of corporate ownership that sort of that tarnished the name Inglenook.
Apparently pride didn't come first in that era.
No.
But then 1975, the Inglenook ship was righted when Francis and Eleanor Coppola purchased the property and the Nibon Mission, although not the chateau and not the Inglenook name. Mm-hmm. So out of respect to Gustav, he called the new winery Nibon Coppola.
Right. And then it was called Rubicon for a while, but they started producing in 1978 Rubicon, and from the back property, which is the most privileged historical part of the estate, and includes the mansion. So,
yeah, that's a sight you don't see from the road, but when you walk up the hill here next to the chateau and you look down over that spot, boy, it's beautiful back there, isn't it?
Every visitor, and I mean, you're welcome to go up afterwards just to pay your respects, but if we just walk outside of the chateau and up on the knoll, looking back is one of the most remarkable views of the valley. Yeah. It's exquisite.
I have seen it before, and fortunately it was spring or summer, so it was very green, unlike right now. Well, Coppola was smart enough to hire Andre Chelischev as a consultant, and by then the Rubicon wine was already aging and ready for its release in 85.
Yeah, and then he had this crazy idea that the wine would be released 7 years after it was made. So the releases took a while to begin. But we know earlier this year, we tasted all of the Rubicon wines made back to 1978, just about 10 months ago. And it's remarkable how, you know, the terroir, I mean, the real essence of the vineyard comes through. And these wines are so amazing. Even 1978 and 1979 in particular were quite staggeringly good.
That must have been quite enjoyable.
Yeah.
How long did that take?
The tasting, we took our time.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's not something you want to rush through.
A good half day to go through the wines.
And the announcement of the Rubicon Estate Heritage Clone Number 29 made quite a historic statement, didn't it?
Yeah, and it was a field selection, based on those original cuttings that Gustav brought back here and planted in 1879. So,
They proved it through DNA, right?
Absolutely.
It's great to have that knowledge and that connection to the past.
Yeah, and you'll find a lot of that here at Inglenook, just in the chateau we're sitting in. You know, it's hard to believe, but for California, it's remarkable. I mean, it feels like we're sitting in an estate in Bordeaux somewhere.
Right. And then that major announcement occurs in 1990 that you referenced earlier about Wine Spectator announcing that the 1941 Inglenook Cabernet was the best wine of the century.
Yep, it's still one of them.
The best wine of the century. That's quite a statement from Wine Spectator. Out of curiosity, I looked online to see if I could find a price and see if that vintage was even available. Well, at least it was available. According to Christie's Auction House, in 2011, two bottles of the 1941 Inglenook Cabernet Sauvignon from Francis Ford Coppola's private collection sold for $11,400. That's $5,700 a piece. I guess ultimately for the best wine of the century, that's quite a deal. Whew! As you heard in the last segment, initially Francis Ford Coppola was able to purchase portions of the winery in 1975, but not the name Inglenook. Out of respect for founder Gustav Niebaum's legacy, he called the winery Niebaum Coppola Estate Winery. But then finally, in 2011, Coppola was able to purchase the remaining property, the chateau, and the name Inglenook. And finally, the winery was a cohesive entity once again.
Yeah, the Coppolas are really unique because, you know, they just have, you know, when you talk to Francis, he has this long-term view. A lot of us think just of today and, you know, short-term goals, but with Francis, all the decisions he's made vis-a-vis Inglenook have to do with, you know, things. He's just looking generations down the line. And yes, there was some confusion about what the property was called during that lag period. But he knows in time, people will just remember Inglenook. And even when, you know, it's his children or grandchildren running it, for him, it's just keeping Inglenook intact has been just his life dream, really.
I wonder if it's because as a movie director, you have to consider the movie you're going to make. Is this going to be something that's going to be watched in generations? And certainly the ones he's worked on have met that goal.
Yeah, I think I recently just translated an article from French, from Le Monde, where Francis is sort of comparing art in the form of film and art in the form of wine, and he says some really cool things. One is that both rely on really good starting material, you know, and you know, a film would be nothing if it didn't have a story. I mean, it tells a story. And he says the same with wine. It would just be red or white if it didn't have a story that went with it. And that's so true. And here we're very steeped in a story that goes way back in time.
And these are the stories that I enjoy telling. And even modern winemakers, you know, they all have their own unique story.
Absolutely. It adds texture, you know, to the wine just as the tannins do. And, you know, I think good film or good wine both stand the test of time.
And speaking of that, another project Coppola undertook was restoring the chateau, which is strikingly beautiful. And it must be amazing to come here to work when you do every day.
Well, you know, it's funny, but this has not... It's true every time I come here that I feel a little bit like I'm in a movie. Because to drive from, you know, my home in St. Helena and walk onto this property... I mean, didn't you feel that when you walked here today? I mean, it's just remarkable. And I seriously, and it's, you know, yes, we work for a film director here, but in spite of that, it just feels there's something surreal and just magical about the place. And once it gets under your skin, you stay.
It's kind of like going back in time in a sense, too.
Absolutely. But it's sort of past, present, and future all rolled up into one.
And French winemaker Philippe Bascol of Chateau Margaux is now at the helm here, and it must be fascinating to work with him.
Yeah, he has not only a remarkable palate and a great passion for wine, he's just a really nice guy. And so he's back. He's actually running Chateau Margaux and still directing the winemaking here at Inglenook simultaneously, which is a feat that is something.
Which suggests to me that your responsibilities are pretty important here.
Yeah, because he's only here 10% of the time. So, you know, the rest of the time, I help, you know, be a liaison and just keep, you know, I kind of think winemaking for the long term is like, it's like steering a big, you know, a ship, and you turn it very slowly. We don't want to make any sudden course corrections. We've really, you know, since Philippe started, going on 7 years ago here at Inglenook, he was really able to make those major course corrections and bring the style back to something that is honest and reflects the true, you know, gravitas, the true essence of the property, and also evokes those wines of the Daniel era of the 40s and 50s.
Yeah, and what a perfect person to hire to be part of that.
Absolutely. You know, Philippe has a unique perspective, it's just one of the many things that makes this such a, you know, a rich, meaningful project.
What's your background? What was your path in leading up to Inglenook?
Well, I started out pre-med, actually, at UC Davis, but in short order ended up in the viticulture and enology program there and graduated in 1981 and then had the good fortune to go off to Bordeaux for a couple of years, study at the university there, and then went on in 1982 to do an internship for Christian Moex, who invited me back to be the first winemaker at Domino's Estate. So I was, you know, very surprised and excited to be a winemaker fresh out of school. And so I stayed there for over a dozen years and then went to Camus for about 8 years. Yep, and spent some time at Swanson Vineyards. I've done consulting and have my own brand as well.
Why don't you take a moment to impress my listeners with the wine you're making now here at Inglenook? And you know, as I'm sitting here, and we have two glasses that you poured, the Rubicon and the Cabernet, and the aroma is just pulling me in. So, actually, while you're talking, I think I'm going to take my first sip.
Please. Yeah, these two wines we have in front of us, first of all, they're 2014 vintage wines and bottled last year. And they've had about 6-7 months in the bottle now. But the Rubicon, it's 97% Cabernet, so it's still, both of these wines represent that variety very closely. But Rubicon, you know, all of our wines, we seek balance. We seek probably elegance first, and then balance. And we really try to avoid extremes. Extremes are very easy, actually, to achieve by doing nothing or by doing too much. So sometimes, I think, especially here in Napa, not that you're not trying to be expressive, your very best to make the best possible wine, but avoiding the extremes of something that has no character and something that has too much extract is our mission here. So
and tannin can be one of those as well. And I noticed these are very moderate with the tannins.
Yeah, it's actually quantitatively there's a lot of tannin in this wine. But the reason it appears so, it appears drinkable and wine is for enjoyment after all, right? Is because the quality of the tannins, so that are there. And yes, we're very careful, you know, about 3 weeks of maceration. We could have gone much longer. We could have, you know, run the fermentation much hotter and tried to extract every scintilla of tannin. But that's not our mission here. We're looking for elegance. And again, we've tasted those wines from many decades ago and know what the true potential is here.
I met you in October during the Wine and Spirits Top 100 event, and it was no surprise to see you there. It was the 2014 Rutherford Napa Valley Rubicon Cabernet, which we're enjoying right now, that got you on the list of one of the top 100 wines of the year in the world. So congratulations on hitting that accolade.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I think the wine speaks for itself. I mean, I could prattle on about it, but I think, yeah, great wine just speaks for itself.
And it must be a thrill to be there with other winemakers from across the globe who have also just such an amazing quality of wine and winemaking style.
Absolutely. Yeah, we were just a couple tables away from Kathy Corrison, who I've known for over 30 years. And we were talking about how amazing it is to be surrounded by, you know, there was French, German, Austrian around us. And it was, I think Inglenook earned that.
Fit right in.
Absolutely.
Can you tell me about, I know you're busy when you're here and working, but can you tell me what the guests might be able to experience with the tastings and tasting experiences here?
Well, there's a range of options, and I know Napa Valley is known for its hospitality, but I don't believe, with maybe one or two exceptions, that there's anyone in Napa Valley who is more hospitable. And I think at a winery, and I think it's true really for any business, it's the ownership sort of, it trickles down from there. Not that the Coppolas are here every day. They're definitely not. They have a lot of other things they're involved in. But their sense of being welcoming and warm and hospitable translates, you know, trickles down to everyone here on the property. And it's you really feel that when you come here. So I think whether you want to drop by the bistro for a glass of wine, which you can do anytime, even though there's a big gate that's closed, you check in at the gate and make your case and they'll let you in. Or whether if you want...
I'm worthy.
But if you want to make you can make an appointment and actually do a blending session in the cellar we're in right now. And there's a whole range of options. So I think, it's pretty unique.
Well, the other thing that you offer here that many places don't in Napa Valley is the historic beauty. It's eye-catching. It's just stunning.
Yeah, there's no place like it. I mean, it's the largest contiguous property here in Rutherford. And a lot of the property is up on the bench, so it's this gentle sloping up to the Mayacamas Mountains. And actually, the estate, people really don't realize this, but includes 1,500 acres behind the vineyard up on the mountain, up behind the Nibong Mansion.
I can't imagine that Gustav would be an easy man to impress, being a self-made man that he was. But if he were here today, I would think he'd be proud of what he sees.
Absolutely. And I don't think it's sort of some obsession on the part of the Coppolas to do exactly what Nibong did. But, you know, I think they recognized how well done it was. And they just out of respect for that legacy, they wanted to perpetuate it. And I think, you know, they've succeeded. But it'll never be something that you can let up on. It takes constant vigilance. And, you know, the estate, whether it's the vineyard, the mansion, the chateau where we're sitting, everything is really meticulously taken care of. So I think this level of care is something that's really important to maintain, and the Coppolas do that.
Well, Chris, thanks for your time. I appreciate you getting in here early to chat with me and share the Inglenook story.
My pleasure. And always drink wine that you like.
I sure did enjoy the Cabernet and the highly respected Rubicon. Boy, the Rubicon was extraordinary and lives up to its $200 price. And I don't say that very often. Aside from those two and their 1882 Cabernet, Inglenook also crafts a Zinfandel, Reserve Syrah, a Sauvignon Blanc, and a Roussanne-Marsanne Viognier blend. You can read all about their history and more details about their wine at inglenook.com. And again, it is a beautiful property if you get a chance to go visit. Thanks to Chris Phelps for being a gracious host. If you're listening to this on iTunes or another podcast provider, you can learn more about my show at onthewineroad.com and on Facebook as well. I'm on Instagram under the name JD Wineroad and on Twitter @JD Wineroad. I'm Jeff Davis. Thanks for joining me today.